Hello there, and welcome back to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in your favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Nisch. I'm a professor of earth sciences, a planetary geologist, and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores. I'm a professor of space engineering here at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, a speculative fiction nerd, and in what might be important for today, I teach a second year geophysics course.
So this week, we're covering the movie The Core, the classic from 2003. In this movie, if you're not familiar with it, the outer core has stopped spinning, which appears to weaken or change the magnetic field of the Earth, which prompts changes on Earth that threaten to kill everyone.
Right, so physics 101, hot metal moving fast makes an electromagnetic field. The spinning liquid outer core is the engine that drives the EM field. And that's where we have our problem.
This engine has stalled. The core of the Earth has stopped spinning.
The U.S. military recruits this ragtag team of scientists and engineers to build and operate a craft that will travel to the core of the Earth and set off a series of nuclear bombs to so-called jumpstart the planet. The team has to make many sacrifices on their perilous journey to and from the core, but in the end, they succeed in their task, and two of the Terranauts survive to tell their story to the world.
So, Catherine, based on the movies and the TV shows that we've been covering, this one must be really near and dear to your heart.
Stuff. So I can't recall my history with this movie, but in the two decades since it's come out, it's really gotten a reputation for some of the worst science that's ever been portrayed in a Hollywood movie. It's really one of those so bad it's good kind of movies. In fact, this movie had so many problems, it might have prompted the creation of the so-called Science and Entertainment Exchange, which is an initiative that was led by actor Dustin Hoffman to try to present better science in movies. Because if the science is so bad it takes you out of the story, that's a problem, right?
Oh, absolutely.
But still, I think it has a certain charm to it. Its description in Rotten Tomatoes, I think, sums it up rather well. They say it's a B-movie with its tongue planted firmly in cheek. The core is so unintentionally, intentionally bad that it's a hoot. So, John, what's your history with this movie? In talking to you earlier, it sounds like you haven't seen it until recently.
That's right. I think we've got a good combo here because, you know, this is something that you remember from way back when, whereas for me, I'd heard about The Core. Its reputation had preceded it. And so I had managed to avoid it until last Friday. So I have only just seen it. I've seen it very fresh. And I've got to say, it's really fascinating. There's a lot of places where they don't have to talk science, but they do. They give themselves more rope and they hang themselves with it very effectively.
Yeah, they really, I think, are trying to make this a movie about science. You know, one of the main characters is a college professor. He's trying to lecture at you sometimes, along with this sort of Carl Sagan-like character who's also trying to lecture at us, which is fine, right? That's what professors do, but half the time they get it completely wrong. So it's being lectured by a really bad college professor, I guess, is the problem.
Indeed. And I've got to say, looking at the show notes on this one, I think we might have set a record for science gripes.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, there are a lot. I mean, there's so many, it's so bad, you just have to laugh. And I almost wonder if that's what the filmmakers were going for. I don't know, we'll talk about this later, but maybe they were trying their best and they got it wrong, but some of the science they present is just laughable. So why don't we get into our first section here?
That sounds really good. I'm looking forward to that because I did some reading, I think, after seeing this movie, and it sounds like it's a lot better than it might have been, at least in the first draft. So in terms of the science grabs, well, I mean, my favorite place to start has got to be those microwaves.
Oh, right. The microwaves. Wow. So they're like, cooking the water off the coast of San Francisco, melting the Golden Gate Bridge. Oh, that scene is amazing, but completely incorrect.
Oh, yeah. But then they don't melt the cars, though. Cars apparently are tougher than the bridge.
Yes, somehow that thin sheet of aluminum is more than a giant bridge made of steel, I presume, melting and causing the cars to tumble into the water below. Right, but this doesn't happen, right? We are constantly bombarded by microwave radiation. from space. In fact, our atmosphere is invisible to electromagnetic radiation at exactly two places. Visible, so we can see the sun, and the microwave. We don't see those waves because, you know, we don't have eyeballs that can recognize those wavelengths. But yeah, all of that microwave and radiation from space is constantly bombarding the Earth. But it's at such low levels that it just doesn't matter. The magnetic field doesn't block it. It has nothing to do with microwave radiation. So whether or not the magnetic field is here or not is irrelevant. It has more to do with the composition of the Earth's atmosphere and what absorbs light and what doesn't. So this was just ridiculous. So don't worry, if the Earth ever loses its magnetic field, you're not going to get microwaved. You're just going to be subject to the same amount of microwave radiation you currently are being subjected to.
Well, the other thing, as I think we've learned over time with these disaster movies, is that you want to stay away from these well-known monuments because that's where all the bad stuff tends to happen. Like the thing that just drove me nuts about the movie is you have this global effect, allegedly, from the core of the Earth stopping spinning. And yet it has all of these like super, super localized things. It's not like, you know, all of the Bay Area gets covered in microwaves. It's like they show this little tiny cone moving along. And then the same thing happens in Boston with the pacemakers and then with the birds in Trafalgar Square. It's like, goodness, why is it so darn localized?
I guess it's a good thing I live in the middle of nowhere, southwestern Ontario, where there aren't any recognizable landmarks. But John, you should stay away from the CN Tower.
That's true. We're a good place for filming, I think, because you can see all that downtown from here.
Yeah, the effects they show are just ridiculous. The magnetic field, for good or for ill, does not have that much of an effect on the Earth. Really, what would happen if we lost the magnetic field, which, by the way, we likely have in the past, you know, maybe we'll have like a slightly increased risk of cancer from additional radiation coming in from space, but you're not going to be broiled. You're not going to be struck by a lightning bolt, and your pacemaker is probably not going to just drop out of nowhere. So don't worry. You guys are safe, even if the magnetic field suddenly disappears.
That's true. But still, from the conversation we had ahead of time, Catherine, I think it is a bad idea to store your nitroglycerin in these monuments or in statues or in the road.
Yeah. So there's a scene in The Core where these massive lightning bolts hit the Colosseum in Rome and it explodes. And I was like, why would that happen? So I was talking to my husband. He's like, well, maybe they connected their lightning bolt to their storage supply of nitroglycerin in the basement. Like, there's no way a lightning bolt would cause rock to shatter unless you were storing explosives there for no reason. And not only the Colosseum, like all of Rome gets destroyed. As John said, like the roads get ripped up, other houses get destroyed. Honestly, Rome would probably be a pretty good place for a lightning strike because I don't think it has a lot of wooden houses, right? There's a lot of stone there, which is not really susceptible to lightning strikes. You're much more concerned about a fire lighting your wooden house on fire, right, from a lightning strike than anything made of stone.
The whole thing with Rome struck me as like it was perplexing, right? Because it's almost like, you know, why would you create these superstorms? You know, what connection does that have to the magnetic field and whatnot? So I actually had to go out hunting to find out, you know, what bizarre article the makers of the movie had seen that gave them this idea, or maybe they just decided, you know what, let's have a grab bag of bad things that happened to the planet here. But I did find that there was once a theory that you had cosmic rays, which then created ionized particles, which served as cloud condensation nuclei. So potentially you had more clouds when you had more cloud condensation nuclei. And there is, in fact, a relationship between the amount of galactic cosmic rays that we get on Earth and the solar cycle. When the sun is at solar max, when that solar wind is stronger, you actually have these GCRs get pushed back a little bit and you get a little bit less of that. But it's such a minor effect. And in terms of being able to even really affect the weather, that's been debunked for years. But that's the closest I get to maybe a reason that got included in this movie.
Yeah, I was baffled. So you've explained it better than I could figure it out. Because, yeah, typically lightning is formed in clouds through this charge separation that you get in a cloud. And the clouds are, as far as I know, not affected by the magnetic field. Though, as John points out, you do need these cloud condensation nuclei to form a cloud. But often this is just in the atmosphere anywhere, and the anyway in the form of dust or similar small particles that just exist in the atmosphere. So it's not like you need extra cosmic rays to make lightning. In fact, there are places like Venus, which has no magnetic field, and we see no lightning there. I don't think there's any strong correlation between increased lightning and lack of a magnetic field. So I was pretty baffled by why they were going in that direction.
It seems like an own goal, and there's a lot of them in there. Like thinking about the, when they talk about the Earth's core having stopped spinning and whatnot, they give numbers, but the numbers don't seem to correlate to anything that is recognizable to me or to Catherine. I mean, what was it? Trillions of tons of hot metal spinning at 1,000 miles an hour?
Right. I wrote that down very carefully because I'm like, I'm going to fact check this. Because a lot of what they say earlier is right. They get the size of the core correct and so forth. But I'm like, is it really going at 1,000 miles an hour? That's extremely fast. And no, it's not. As you would expect, the convection that powers the motion in the inner core is pretty languid. The numbers I found were on the orders of kilometers per year, so nowhere near 1,000 miles an hour. They were slightly closer with the mass. The outer core has a mass of about 2 times 10 to the 24th kilograms. So that would be a trillion, trillion kilograms, not a trillion, trillion tons, which is 1,000 times different. So maybe they just made an error there. But the 1,000 miles an hour is bananas. That is inaccurate. They also imply that the entire core, outer core, is spinning. But from what I've read, it's actually smaller eddies, so smaller motions within the core that generate the magnetic field, not one giant motion in the core.
Yeah, that matches with what I've heard as well. And I think this is an area where we need to caution our listeners a little bit, because I found the Google AI hallucinating wildly, on this particular topic. You really, unfortunately, need to get into the literature a little bit here.
Oh my gosh. Okay, this is a side note, but I hate that Google AI. I'm constantly trying to look things up and they're spitting information on me that I cannot trust. So then I have to go dig deeper into the list to find something more trustworthy. So if you're out there, do not just read the Google AI summary. Go find a source that you can trust. Even Wikipedia is pretty good, but don't read the Google AI. Sorry, side note.
Oh, definitely. Well, one thing I found fascinating, aside from the fact that, okay, maybe we question the intelligence of the people creating the movie, but also the people in the movie seem to think that most people on Earth are pretty dumb too, in that they can hide this, complete stopping of the outer core and the geodynamo. They can hide that from them with the help of a really fancy hacker. So I don't know. I feel like we've got some trouble here. I mean, the effects, obviously, I mean, they're depicted in the movie. They're devastating. You'd think people would wonder what the heck's going on with that. Not to mention, I think a few people might own a compass and might want to use it, perhaps even as part of their job. But apparently, even in 2003, early days of the internet, good hacker can go and make that all go away.
Yeah, it really is. I do not believe one person could hack the planet and, make it so that people don't realize what is happening right above their heads is extremely strange. It does actually, it's an early indicator of sort of the misinformation that is now being spread right on the internet. So even now when people see things that are obvious, if they have somebody on the internet telling them that up is down and down is up, they might actually believe it. So although in 2003, I think this was a nutty storyline, and I don't even know where they were going with it, because clearly people are going to notice things and talk to each other. But it does seem like an early predecessor to the sort of misinformation we're dealing with today.
Definitely. It's interesting. They feel that the information has to be hidden. If the information was out there, that then people would believe it and take action and go with it. Whereas you get to other movies recently, like, for instance, Don't Look Up, where the information is out there, but there is this movement to ignore it. So it's interesting. I did love, by the way, that the software apparently is very simple. It just looks for keywords, and then it deletes all the files with those keywords. I don't know. There seems like there's a modern-day parallel to that one.
Oh, yes. Yeah, with all the craziness going on in the United States right now, with people just wholesale getting rid of words like bias, right, which can have many different meanings, many of them unrelated to the EDI efforts they seem to be wanting to suppress. So they're just shooting themselves in the foot there by trying to get rid of some keywords that have multiple meanings and can't just be deleted wholesale.
Sadly, they didn't have the guy from the core who apparently is more effective at using that kind of software.
We just need Rat. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
And a really good cyber cafe, which we'll get to later.
Oh, yes, yes. Gotta love that. So I don't know. This is a bit of a lightning round. Where do you want to go next, Catherine?
Well, of course, there's that amazing scene in The Mantle where they crack through a geoid and end up getting stuck and then go outside in their spacesuits. John sent me his notes in advance, and I'm trying to find them, but it was something like, oh my God, they go outside in The Mantle, 3 exclamation points.
That's exactly right.
Which is crazy, right? The pressures there are bananas. They would be crushed, and their suits seem incapable of, you know, adjusting to these massive pressures. They're just these thin sort of space suits. They don't even look like pressure suits that you'd wear on the moon.
Yeah, so, they're just shiny.
They look nice. But this whole scene is bananas. A, that there would be a geoid down there, be that large, that they could walk around in it outside of their unobtainium spacecraft or terracraft, I don't know what we're going to call it, and not die. But the thing that really got me is, why do they have spacesuits to begin with, right? They're talking about the pressures under the Earth as being massive, which they are, right? No human could survive these pressures. So why would you ever expect to go outside of your unobtainium ship to walk around? So that whole scene was just crazy.
Yeah, they definitely anticipated this ridiculousness, but you're right. It's one of these things where it must have gotten lodged in the filmmaker's brain, and they decided we're doing it, you know. But everything about it is wrong. The fact that the thing is open, the fact that you could get out in it, the fact that you've got these gigantic crystals which apparently stop this ship, which can travel through rock, and they've got to actually go and unwedge the thing. I mean, the fact that, you know, they put a hole in the geode and then that fills up with lava. I mean, the mantle's not liquid, so that's not going to happen either. And then one of the characters gets killed by falling into the lava and he sinks. And, you know, one of my favorite tropes in these sorts of, you know, science fiction / James Bond movies is this idea of killing people with lava. Lava is really, really dense and you are not. So if you were to fall into lava, you would just sit on top. You wouldn't, you know, go for a bath and that. So, oh my goodness. It's just like this whole section of the movie. It's like, what?
No, I know. My son's birthday was a month ago, and somebody gave him a geoid as a gift. It's like a little kid's kit that you can kind of like crack it open and see the geoid. But like, I cracked it with a hammer on my basement floor, right? I was not at how many gigapascals are there in the mantle. Like, it was very easy to crack this geoid. I don't know how it would have survived under that massive amount of pressure. They try to come up with something about cobalt, which I did not understand. Like, the whole geoid would have to be surrounded by the same unobtainium they have in their spacecraft to make this work, right? So the whole thing was ridiculous and kind of takes you out of the movie more than a little bit.
Yeah, for a movie that is trying hard to be really scientific and really motivated by that, I just had all these flashbacks to like creature feature stuff from like the 40s and the 50s, you know, which is just pure fantasy. And it just is weird. It doesn't seem to belong in the rest of the movie.
Yeah. The other scene, which I should have brought up earlier, but I'll mention here, is that scene in Trafalgar Square where the birds go nuts. And there's a lot of issues with that scene as well. First of all, while some birds may navigate long distances based on the magnetic field, like if you're going across a square, you're probably going to use your eyeballs, right? You're not going to rely on a very minimally changing magnetic field over the course of 100 meters. So why would they go crazy? I don't know. And then they show these pigeons just like smashing through windows everywhere. And anyone who has ever lived in a house with windows knows that birds occasionally will run into a window. And really, you should put up little dots or pictures on your window to avoid them doing this, because the window is not at stake. The bird is at stake, right? Like, they are more likely to break their neck than smash the window. A pigeon only weighs a pound, right? There's no way they're going to smash through a window. In fact, I have direct experience with this. I was once on a trip in Mexico And we were driving down a highway, probably around 50 miles an hour. And out of nowhere, this chicken comes careening towards us. It must have hit the car in front of us, tumbling end over end, smashes our windshield. So this is a chicken, so it weighs more than a pigeon. It was going a lot faster. And it did not crack the glass. It didn't shatter it. You know, we were fine. The chicken, I do not think, was fine. But birds do not shatter glass. So this whole scene was just ridiculous.
Oh my goodness. I'm going to embarrass myself here a little bit, but I believe there is a classic horror film. It might even be Hitchcock with Jimmy Stewart, which has that scene where all of the birds are coming and the glass breaks and whatnot. All I can think of is maybe they were channeling that. They wanted to have something like that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a good visual, but it's just scientifically implausible.
Well, what do you think? Shall we do just a few more quick hits, get it out of our system before we go on to the, there are actually things that we like scientifically about this. Don't lose faith.
It was not entirely wrong. Yeah. Well, you seem to have some concerns with that scene where they were cutting a hole in the mountain with a giant laser.
I know the laser just seemed to make the rock disappear and it didn't go anywhere. You know, this thing shoots right through a mountain and all that rock has to go somewhere. It has to be vaporized. It has to be turned into dust. And there is a little bit of dust, but it just sort of like magically disappears from the universe. So that frustrated me a little bit. And the side of the hole is cool to the touch. They actually go and put their hands on it seconds later. And that's not how heat transfer works, people. So that bothered me a little bit. There's a lot of little things, you know? Like we have the scientists becoming Terranauts again. We saw this with Contact. And we understand you can't cast the astronauts, the Terranauts, completely different from, you know, the people you had in the first half of the movie. But this seems to be a thing.
Yeah, the whole crew composition was baffling to me. Like, why did they need six people, for one thing, other than to slowly kill them off one by one? I mean, that's why they had six people. But for an experimental craft like this, you might have, I don't know, two people would be my guess. I mean, even in the space shuttle at the opening scenes, there were only three people on the space shuttle. So why would you have so many? And why would you pick these people? It didn't even make sense to have astronauts on this ship because they're not familiar with it. They have no idea how to drive it. You know, the only person I think that made sense was Braz, the guy who built it, right? But everyone else seems sort of peripheral to the story.
It's true. And they had an awful lot of compartments in that thing. I mean, it came in handy. Don't get me wrong here, because when they had to put the nuclear weapons in different compartments, thank goodness they had a whole train of this thing. But still, it seems a little much.
So no sleeping compartment, apparently. I didn't see anyone sleep, and they were down there for about 2 days. So no wonder they started making mistakes. They were exhausted. I mean, you go a little nutty if you haven't slept in a few days.
Oh, goodness.
The other thing that was really bothersome was the final scenes in the movie where they end up getting spit out near Hawaii. And in the movie, they say, it looks like she found a space near some tectonic plates near Hawaii. But there aren't any tectonic plates near Hawaii. Hawaii is famously a hotspot with direct, you know, movement from the mantle up towards Hawaii. There are no plates. There is only plate, the Pacific plate, of which Hawaii is in the middle of it. So unless they just like magically found the hotspot, I don't know how they ended up coming through the mantle near Hawaii.
It is literally the furthest from a plate boundary of any place on Earth. So that's just fascinating. And they end up at 800 feet of water, which is hard to find near Hawaii.
Yeah, I actually looked up the bathymetry, the ocean water depth around Hawaii. And unless you're right next to one of the islands, it's much, much deeper than that. So again, I don't know where they ended up, how they were so shallow. It's just a baffling ending to this movie.
Well, maybe that's a good place for us to put a pin in the science grips. We could be here forever, but we know we want to make good use of your time, dear listener, and tell you in just a minute about what we actually liked about the movie. So we'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. Believe it or not, there are things about the core from a scientific perspective that we liked. So we're going to take a few minutes now and talk about some of these things. And I'm just going to start with the idea that they tried. You know, they didn't succeed, but damn it, we need people out there in the world who care about science, who want to see science in entertainment and movies. You know, if nothing else, it gives Catherine and I something to do every couple of weeks. But, you know, they really tried. And so I feel like they should be rewarded a little bit from emphasizing that science.
I was impressed that it wasn't entirely wrong. I was going into this movie from my memory being like, everything they say is going to be wrong. But there were some things that were correct. And it sounds like the science advisors and the screenwriter had some pushback from other folks, maybe the producers, who wanted even crazier things. I heard mention of involving dinosaurs somehow in this movie. So at least they got rid of the dinosaurs. And you know, and like I said, there were some aspects of the movie that were correct. But gosh, I feel like, yeah, the science got ripped away from the science advisors here.
Well, one thing that they mentioned that I think you picked up on as well was this idea of the super deep borehole that actually is something that exists.
Yep. So they mentioned that the deepest hole ever dug is 7 miles deep, and that's correct. The shaft in question is called the Kola Super Deep Borehole, which is in Russia, near the border with Norway. So this was a project, I think, that mainly happened in the 80s, and they achieved their deepest depth, 7 miles, in 1989. But this is, you know, a tiny hole, and they were only able to get down 7 miles. So it is extremely difficult to penetrate into the Earth, right? They never exited the crust. They never got to the mantle. So getting to the core is just kind of a ludicrous concept, given what we know about our previous efforts to drill into the Earth.
And it is such a huge effort. It was incredibly expensive. It was something that took decades, and they had planned to go deeper, but they just didn't have the equipment to do it in the end. So hard.
It's, yeah, the pressures are enormous. The temperatures are enormous. It's just not an easy thing to do. And, you know, something like, there is no unobtainium. That's why they call it that, right? It's this magic mystery MacGuffin that a lot of sci-fi movies and books use when they don't know how to actually explain something scientifically.
Well, they just got it from Pandora. Don't you know, it's part of the whole effort.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, their previous mining efforts on Pandora. Thanks, James Cameron. The other part here that was partially true and partially incorrect was that opening scene with the space shuttle. So to start the movie off, they have the shuttle landing. The magnetic field disrupts its navigation systems. They end up in the middle of downtown LA having to land this space shuttle, which is a very cool scene, although I guess a little bit more troubling given that this was right after 9/11 and also shortly after the Columbia disaster. So bad timing there, but they did get the timing right in terms of how long it takes the space shuttle to land from sonic boom to touchdown. And indeed, space shuttles do produce a sonic boom. I've actually experienced one. I had the opportunity during that summer in Houston in 1999 to see the space shuttle Columbia descend over Houston on its way to Florida. And I did hear that sonic boom, but it was much higher up. You would not be able to see it sitting in Dodger Stadium, other than like a rapidly moving bright spot, you know, 60,000 feet up. So partially right, partially wrong in terms of that shuttle landing.
Well, I think a big thing that they get right here are the core reversals, because we do see these happening in geologic history. We can see the changes in the magnetism that's actually preserved in rocks. We call it paleomagnetism. And there's been a lot of these things over the geologic time that we can take a look at. That this is really helpful to us, in fact, because it helps us to date sediment on the bottom of the seafloor. And you can see this really neat banding effect as new seafloor is created under different magnetic conditions. So the idea that you can have changes in the geodynamo is not at all crazy.
Yeah, this is, I mean, a hugely important piece of information that has changed our knowledge of the geology of our planet. When these were discovered on the ocean floor, it was a big revelation that the magnetic field would flip, but also it's allowed us to date parts of the oceanic floor and prove that plate tectonics is happening. So seeing these magnetic reversals that are symmetric about these spreading centers on the ocean floor, you know, was a big piece of evidence that supported plate tectonics theory, which is now the driving theory behind earth sciences. And so during these transitions, when the magnetic field flips, you know, it's thought that the magnetic field will significantly weaken, maybe not vanish completely, but, you know, it will become much weaker, more chaotic. So the things that we saw in this movie have probably happened multiple times over Earth's history. And I know some people have tried to link it to see if it's consistent with extinction events. Has that effect on life that they implied in the movie? But I don't think there's any good evidence that they're linked to extinction events. So these things happen and life goes on. So that's good.
Indeed. I wonder if, because this has been in the news periodically, I think, over the last few decades, you know, are we going into another core reversal now, or a geodynamo reversal? And I wonder if this is what got, this is the seed that got the filmmakers thinking about this movie.
Yeah, it must have been. We're kind of overdue for a core reversal. The last one was almost 800,000 years ago, and they typically happen every 400,000-500,000 years. So we're kind of due for one, but it's chaotic, right? There's no periodicity to these core reversals. They just kind of happen randomly. So maybe we're not due for one. It's hard to tell, but it could feasibly happen. Luckily, as I said, you'll be fine. Don't worry about it.
Well, the other nice thing, in addition to getting that bit right, they also have the structure of the Earth right. So we've got, the main character picks up a peach, rips it open, and describes the interior structure of the Earth, you know, analogous to the peach. And it's not that bad. And in fact, the numbers that are stated as part of that scene are actually not that bad. And in fact, I hate to say this, Catherine, but the size of the outer core and the size of Mars are so similar. And I hadn't known that. I am stealing that. I'm using that in my outreach presentation. So I learned something nice. And got something useful professionally out of the core.
Nice. Although that final scene where they torch the peach with hairspray is awful. Right. I mean, as we talked about, microwaves are not going to boil the planet. And it was hilarious, like the two of them doing this little interplay, like they've done it a million times before. Like this is a common demonstration that geology professors do, was just kind of hilarious. Like, I've never seen this before. It's not scientifically plausible. I don't know where they came up with that, but it was kind of a funny scene for a scientist.
Oh, definitely. Because there are some of those demos that I think we all know. And if someone started doing it, we could go and play our part very easily.
Yeah. I will also say I've never brought a trumpet into my lecture before, but maybe I should to show how waves change speed in different media.
Yeah, I thought that was fun. I mean, you know, you know that the movie is going to a bad place when at the very start you have that scene in the lecture theater and the geophysicist is talking about waves traveling through the Earth as sound. He's not wrong about that, but I don't know any geophysicist who would talk about it in quite that way. So I don't know, something like that, you know, it's kind of good and bad. Like maybe it felt like they were really trying, okay, we're going to bring the audience into this thing, but it was very awkward.
I agree. Even some of the words they used were like just a little off. They were talking about gaining wavelength and losing frequency, which are not words I've ever put together, right? I think trying to say is that wavelength increases in rock and there's a decrease in frequency, but losing frequency is such a weird way of saying that. So they were trying really hard, but the words were just a little bit jumbled. I do have to mention, since we're talking about that classroom scene, that I've actually been in that classroom multiple times. That's Hennings 201 at the University of British Columbia, where I did my undergraduate degree. That's the physics building. And in fact, I was there when they were filming this movie. I was trying to get into the building to get to the computer lab. And this big guy in a trench coat, it might have been one of those actors playing the FBI agents, stopped me and told me to leave. So it was very weird because there were not a lot of people around, just this one dude like telling me to turn around and go home. But it definitely brought back memories of my undergraduate experience at UBC, because I have spent many an hour learning proper physics in that lecture hall.
I think having spent some formative years in Vancouver and me in Toronto means that both of us have some odd personal connections with some of the properties that we're talking about.
Yeah, they do love to film sci-fi in Vancouver, and it seems like now they're shifting a bit more to Toronto as well. So I do recognize a lot of these locations.
Indeed. So one thing I kind of want to push on a little here, because I think we feel a little differently about this. So you've got the initial launching of the, you know, of the TerraCraft or whatnot, because why not? Let's put it in the ocean first. You know, this extremely inviscid, low-density material. That's where we want to start our unobtainium train going. And they drop it into the Marianas Trench. And I think there's good and there's bad about that. Certainly, you know, the Marianas Trench is closer to the core than just about anywhere else. Although now that I think about it, Catherine, I think the North Pole would have been even closer because of the oblateness of the Earth. But still, I'll give them that.
You'd still have to start in the ocean, though, at the North Pole. So.
It's true. They could go to Antarctica. I mean, that would be a great scene as well. Yeah, with the ice.
Yeah, missed opportunity.
More costumes. You know, you want to give good work to the costume department in a sci-fi film. But you're going through all this water and just to gain a couple of kilometers. So the idea that you do gain a little bit of room there, I buy that 100%. But it seems like you're really risking the spacecraft from an engineering perspective, dropping it into the deepest column of water there is. I don't know. I feel like you were a little bit more impressed with this than me.
I can be convinced either way. I see the pros and cons, right? You're only gaining like 1% of the distance. You know, the crustal depth at the Marias Trench is only 30 kilometers less than, say, Utah, where they built the thing, right? So out of a total depth of, you know, 3,000 kilometers, that's a minuscule amount. So I can see your point. Maybe this wasn't the best place to launch. Although one of the folks I think who advised on this movie, Dr. Dave Stevenson from Caltech, actually wrote a short paper after this movie came out talking about ways you could actually go to the core using, you know, science that we know about. And he advocated that you might actually need like an earthquake or a bomb to open up a small fissure in order to get your craft. In his case, it was grapefruit sized, but not the size of this massive ship. And so here, actually, they lucked out. I know they were really worried about the earthquake that happened as they were descending through the ocean, but it might have actually helped them, you know, open that fissure a little bit and get down into the crust.
I think it is just perfect that that paper also requires nuclear weapons to work. It's just fantastic, I have to say. And the other thing I appreciated about it was that there was a communication scheme. So you're not just dropping a grapefruit-sized probe to be never seen again. It's able to communicate back through vibrations, through seismic energy. And we had the question during the movie, how is it that they're able to talk to the Virgil? Maybe that's how.
They were communicating so easily and they never even addressed it. You cannot use radio waves through 1,000 kilometers of rock. Really, the only way you can communicate is through seismic signatures. But they don't talk about that. They don't try to explain it. It's just this magic MacGuffin that they can talk to the surface. And as you pointed out, John, in the notes, is if you're communicating through seismic signals, you know, this secret military base is not the only people who are going to be receiving it, right? Anyone on Earth could see them. And maybe there's some weird encryption or something, but it wouldn't be secret anymore. And a whole point of this movie is they're trying to keep the secret from the public.
Well, maybe, you know, the evil code went out and found, you know, those communications and deleted them too, but it would literally be on every seismometer in the planet. So this might be an interesting one because I think I might have been more impressed than you were with this one. So they talk about restarting the core with nuclear weapons, which is insane and ridiculous. 100%. But I got interested in, okay, how many nuclear weapons did they bring? What's the energy of that? What did they pick a number out of a hat? And maybe they did pick a number out of a hat. But shockingly, the order of magnitude is not crazy. So the power output of the geodynamo is something like a terawatt. And 1,000 tons of TNT worth of nuclear weapons, that's got an energy of about 4 million terajoules. So that's enough to power the geodynamo for a bit over a month. Now, I don't know that anyone has ever done the calculation. How do you start up a geodynamo or stop one? So I don't know how much energy that would take, but it seems like this is, you know, the amount of energy is not totally insane. I mean, it's still terrible and bad, but it's not totally insane, which surprised me.
Yeah, well, that's one good thing you could say about the core. It's not totally insane, just mostly insane. And one other area that I thought was interesting was this point that they made when they get to the core, and there's this big drama because it's lower density than they had expected. And I thought this was it. This piqued my interest because there is some thought that the core has this low density element in it, and we don't really know what it is. But from the seismic signatures, it seems like there's something there that's reducing the density from a, you know, pure iron nickel kind of composition. So it's interesting they brought that up. And so maybe, you know, there are some uncertainties about what we would find in the core, at least in terms of its composition. If you look up the Wikipedia page, they say that it could have anywhere from 0.8 to 5% oxygen. So that's a pretty big error bar, from 0 to 4% silicon. So there's a lot of uncertainties there in what it's actually made of. And so, you know, the densities might shift around a little bit depending on what its precise composition is. And we don't know what that is.
They do a good job of pointing out these inhomogeneities, right? Maybe it just makes for a better CGI thing as this thing is traveling through the core to have like objects and other things floating around. I mean, there's definitely, with those giant diamonds, we had the asteroid dodging scene that is required in movies like this. But you're right, those inhomogeneities do exist. There's some in the core. There's also very famously a whole layer of this stuff that exists right on top of the core mantle boundary that's thought to be perhaps even a remnant of the giant impactor that formed the moon, the Theia body from way back when. So there's a lot of interesting things that we can learn about the deep interior. And the fact that they showed a little bit of this, I think is appreciated.
Yeah, it's clear that they had some idea of what the science was and they were trying to incorporate it into the movie, but you know, they were trying to make it more exciting than actual sciences. Yeah, we don't typically dodge, you know, diamonds the size of Cape Cod in our day-to-day life. Sorry, any people who want to be scientists out there.
It's true. And something else where I jumped in with a plan to debunk and then was proven wrong was, again, our favorite scene, the scene with the geode. I was curious about those crystals because those crystals are pretty darn big. And I was thinking, gee, it would take a long time and the right conditions to grow something of that size. I bet that never happens. But then I found that there are actually caves with crystals that are, you know, single crystals that are 30, 40, 50 feet long. And in fact, one of these had been discovered in Mexico in the year 2000, just a few years before this movie came out. And the pictures from that look so much like that space that they're in. So that was fascinating. It's something I wasn't aware of, actually.
I wasn't aware of that either. Yeah.
All right. Well, perhaps we'll put a pin in the good stuff here, and we'll come back in just a minute with our Of Its Time segment. Welcome back. So we always have a little segment after we talk about the science things that we didn't like so much and the science things that we thought were well better done, in which we talk about how a movie or a TV show is really situated in time. And there are definitely things here in the core. You mentioned the cyber cafe earlier, Catherine. I think that that's dead on. You don't see that so much anymore, do you?
No, I used a lot of those. So this movie, I will say, was filmed in late 2001 to early 2002. It came out in March of 2003. And I distinctly remember going around to these cyber cafes when I was traveling through Europe after graduating in 2004. Because back then, you know, you didn't have the internet in your pocket. Nobody had smartphones. And if you were traveling, you didn't have easy access to a computer and an Ethernet line. So you'd have to actually go to a place. And often they were like coffee shops with computers that you could then go and write emails, check the internet, you know, communicate with people back home. And you don't see those anymore because, again, everyone's got the internet now in their pocket. You don't have to go someplace. So it's very much situates it in this point of time in the years after the internet became a thing, but before smartphones came out, which was only, gosh, I don't know, maybe a decade at most, right?
It was shocking how quick that change happened because I remember doing a few things. Like there's this competition there was in the 2000s called City Chase, where you run around a major city and it's a little bit like a scavenger hunt. And I remember thinking, you know, crap, if only I could bring my computer with me along this. And this was, you know, maybe 2008, 2009. And just a couple of years later, you could. So it was a fascinating change. I think the other thing that was on its way out at the time that this movie was being created was smoking in enclosed spaces, because you do see a lot of the characters taking a drag, and that really kind of dates it, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's only one character. It's the Zimsky character who's obsessed with smoking. But when he asked to light up in the Virgil, it just reminded me of, you know, back in the day when people would smoke in an airplane. Can you imagine?
Yes.
Oh, awful. Or when they would have smoking sections in a restaurant, like that wouldn't drift over to the non-smoking section. I mean, it was so bad. When I was 13, I used to volunteer at this bingo parlor. I think we were trying to raise money for some school trip. And I was just coated in secondhand smoke. This 13-year-old kid, I'd have to take a shower when I got home. I don't even want to know what damage it did to my lungs. But this was just common practice. And it was, I think, shortly after this movie came out that things really started to change. And now I would say, you know, smoking is sort of not a thing you see anymore, not at least to the extent we used to 20, 30 years ago.
Definitely. And when you do see it, it's on the street. I mean, even using that example of the aircraft, I remember taking planes when I was a kid with no smoking symbols that would light up. And now they're just painted on because it's taken for granted that you don't do that in that flying metal tube. The Zinsky character, though, I don't know. That was fascinating because the character, which is played by Stanley Tucci, is just so heavily based on Carl Sagan. But I kind of feel like it's a mirror universe version of Carl Sagan. So, I mean, he's got the tweed coat. He's got the turtleneck. And, you know, he goes and gives a lot of these public presentations. But at the same time, he's vain, he's self-absorbed, he's insecure. He develops a weapon of mass destruction, whereas, of course, the real Carl Sagan was an anti-nuclear crusader. And I wonder here, because I've definitely met scientists of Carl Sagan's era who were not fans of him at all. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's professional jealousy. But I wonder if this is sort of what, you know, Tucci was drawing on a little bit, you know, this kind of dark Carl.
That was my suspicion as well, seeing how he portrayed him. And yes, we're both too young to have met or interacted with Carl Sagan, but I have heard stories from older scientists of him coming to a scientific conference, you know, with his entourage, diving in to give a short talk and then leaving and never actually interacting with the, you know, scientific unwashed masses, so to speak. I don't know how true it is. I never met him. I don't know him personally. So, but I also got the impression that Tucci was probably drawing on Sagan as an inspiration.
It's so fascinating, I think. It's something that if you made the movie 5 years earlier or 5 years later, you wouldn't see a character like that.
Yeah, probably not, because Sagan had recently passed away just a few years before this movie came out. Speaking of when this movie was made, so as I mentioned, they started filming in late 2001. And of course, 2001 is well known for September 11th, 2001. And so this had a big influence on this movie. I don't know how much it came out in the story that they were telling, but certainly there were some practical considerations that were an issue. For example, that scene where they land the space shuttle Endeavour in the Los Angeles River, they were originally supposed to land at LAX, the International Airport in Los Angeles, but because of what had just happened in New York, they would not let the crew film there. So they adjusted and had it land in the river instead. The other way that 9/11 affected this movie is that they landed Aaron Eckhart in the lead role. I guess he was worried after all the uncertainty in the world after 9/11 that he wouldn't have a stable paycheck. So as dumb as this movie is, he wanted to make sure, you know, he could support himself and his family at such an uncertain time in the world. So certainly the effects of 9/11 ripple through this movie quite a bit.
So something else that you mentioned here is Green World Day. I look forward to celebrating this with you every year, Catherine. But, you know, this is something I've not heard about. And you hadn't heard of it either. It doesn't exist. But, you know, there's something, you know, what is it? The things that are not true but sound true, truthy. Mm. And one thing that I feel that was changing over a little bit, you know, around this time was, you know, the environmental movement a little bit. And you saw a lot of this coming up in the 80s and the 90s. And I think things were starting to change around this time because this is the period of, you know, An Inconvenient Truth and climate change entering the more popular understanding in a very different way. So a bit of a changeover for something that was more, I think pollution focused in the 80s and 90s to something that became more climate focused. And I know I'm putting way too much weight on this weird thing that they said, but also it's just interesting. It's sitting in that inflection.
Yeah, it was such a weird way to start the movie. So the movie starts with this festival at Green World Day in Boston, which is actually Vancouver, and people's pacemakers stop and they all drop dead, but only in this very specific region of Boston. And it piqued my curiosity because I'd never heard of it. And you know, nowadays, the more well-known Earth Day is maybe what they were trying to do. But was Earth Day not a thing 20 years ago? I don't remember. So it was just such a strange way to start the movie with this festival, this holiday that no one's ever heard of before, when they easily could have made it something more recognizable like Earth Day, which started in the 70s. So, you know, surely it was around in the 2000s. Very strange. Of course, the other unfortunate thing that surrounds this movie was the Columbia disaster. So this is when the space shuttle Columbia disintegrated upon reentry in the Earth's atmosphere on February 1st, 2003. So they'd already shot this movie by then. They had the trailers and the movie all ready to go. And then, of course, this very similar scene plays out that would probably shock most viewers, right? Even, you know, having seen Columbia Land 4 years prior, it really brought up some emotions. In me, I'd met some of the astronauts who were on Columbia. So, you know, it was very, very fresh in people's minds. So obviously they didn't take it out of the movie. That scene still remains in the movie. And fortunately, you know, those characters do survive the reentry. But they did, in the interest of protecting people, remove it from the trailer. So I think if you find trailers of this, they're unlikely to have that scene. Because again, it was such a fresh disaster that had happened and really high on the minds of people who are interested in science.
Definitely. And they're very careful in the movie to show that this is the Endeavor and it's a different spacecraft. You have to have that scene where the giant thing is coming and comes to a stop right behind someone who's, you know, facing in the other direction, like earphones.
Yeah, I mean, now that we're well removed from the Columbia disaster here 22 years later, I mean, it is a pretty fun scene to see Endeavor skidding along the Los Angeles River right behind this poor, you know, construction worker just trying to do his job. Although interestingly, so some of the characters in this movie are astronauts, and they make a point of saying that the Hilary Swank character, Beck, right? Yeah, her character is the youngest person to ever fly in space. And so I actually looked that up to see who the youngest person to fly in space was. And it was a Russian cosmonaut. I don't know if I'm going to say his name right. German Titov, who flew in space in August of 1961, a little shy of his 26th birthday. That record has sort of been superseded when Oliver Damon flew in Blue Origin in 2021 at the age of 18, but that was a suborbital flight. So you can say Titov still has the record for the youngest person to orbit the Earth, you know, go beyond sub-Earth orbit. So it's entirely possible that Hilary Swank could have been the youngest person in space, as she was 27 years old when they filmed this movie. But it was kind of an interesting little tidbit I hadn't actually ever considered. Can you imagine being 25 and flying in space? Wow, what an experience.
Normally you have people with a little bit more experience, and in fact, your comment about this led me to go and look up and see, because people who are pilots always seem to have ranks that seem quite high. And I wanted to see, well, you know, when do you become a major? And it seems like in the Air Force, a lot of the majors that you have are typically in their 30s. And the prime flying years, apparently, are between 25 and 35, as far as the Air Force is concerned. There have been some in their 20s. So Hilary Swank is not the first. But most of that is during wartime. And of course, wartime tends to create more young senior officers than other times for some reason. So it definitely doesn't seem to be something that happens very commonly. And one unfortunate thing, I think, with the movie, and maybe this does place it in its time a little bit, Swank's character, despite the high rank, despite being an overachiever, despite having been the youngest person in space, is not exactly portrayed as someone of super high confidence and skill, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's one scene where she's helping Aaron Eckhart, again, I've forgotten everyone's names, Josh, I think, to adjust his machine to make it focus better, which is ridiculous. Like, clearly this guy's been working on it for years. He knows the ins and outs. That somebody could just parachute in and like twist a couple knobs and make it better, it's just ludicrous, right? They were clearly trying to make the statement that she was exceptional and the best of the best, but there was no evidence to this other than she could tie his tie really efficiently. So yeah, an interesting use of the actors, I would say, in this movie.
Indeed. But why don't we bring it home with Dustin Hoffman and that little bit that you mentioned at the very start about, you know, the inspiration of this movie in Hollywood.
Right. So people were so unimpressed with this movie. As I said, it had such a reputation for being bad science that people started to think that maybe they should connect the entertainment industry with scientists in a more logical way. Again, better science, you know, keeps people engaged in the movie. It doesn't make them laugh at it or become disengaged with the story. So in 2009, Dustin Hoffman led this campaign to try to do just this, and started this Science and Entertainment Exchange in collaboration with the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. And so since then, they have actually connected people in the entertainment industry to professional scientists to try to help minimize these inaccurate representations in movies like this one. And actually, one of our colleagues I looked up actually consulted on Thor, which is a movie I'd like to do in the future, to try to help them, I think, bring Asgard to life in a scientifically meaningful way.
Well, certainly, I think we can say that things, by and large, have gotten better since the core. So we'll be back in a minute and talk a little bit about how we rated this one overall.
Welcome back. So this is the part of the show where we rate the movie in terms of its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how it holds up over time. So our ratings, I thought, were on a scale of 1 to 5, but it seems like John might have altered that this week. So let's start with the scientific accuracy of the movie. John, you gave this a 0.5, which I did not think was a number we were allowed to give. So can you explain that?
Maybe I'm just used to film reviews and film rankings where you can, in fact, give 0 stars. So I was thinking with this one here, in terms of the science accuracy, yeah, we know this one's bad. But at the same time, it's you can see that they care and you can see that they get a few things right. So I felt like, oh, I can't give them 0 stars. I'll give them a half star, which I think almost emphasizes the badness more than 0 stars would.
Yeah, I had the same thought, although I thought we were starting at 1, so I gave it a 1.5. But yeah, I mean, I was going into this, I expected everything to be wrong. And to see some of it actually, you know, show some resemblance to actual science surprised me. And so I gave them a little extra half point for that. How about its influence? So now 20 years old, how much influence has this had on society, do you think?
Well, that's the question, right? In terms of society, I don't know that the influence has been particularly strong. But in terms of how Hollywood works with scientists and within the scientific community, I think it's got a very strong influence. I gave this one a 4.5 because by being this sort of low watermark, I think it's gotten a much stronger reputation. It's much better known than it would be if it was just a bad movie that did science badly.
Yes, I agree. Within the scientific community, I think this movie is well known. I think it's often shown in science classes to demonstrate bad science versus good science and how you can get things wrong. So despite the fact that it was a pretty bad movie that's now over 20 years old, I think people are still talking about it. Maybe not for the reasons they wanted people to be talking about it, but it certainly hasn't had an influence and has changed, I think, how movies are portrayed in more recent years. All right. And how does it hold up over time? You know, we were talking about how we were firmly placed in the early 2000s in this movie. How does it look in the year 2025?
I gave this one just a straight middle of the road, 2.5 stars, because I feel like it doesn't look any worse now than it looked then. So, you know, it holds up fairly well. There are a few things that date it, but it's just the core, right? You know, what can you do about that? So yeah. Hoping we do more of these. By the way, this was a lot of fun.
Yes, I agree. I'm sorry, dear listener. We're in violent agreement oftentimes. I gave it a 3. The CGI from the early 2000s is typically very bad, but I was impressed that it wasn't as bad as I was thinking it was going to be. So it held up slightly better than I thought it would. And it was still a fun ride here 20 years later. So any final thoughts you want to add about the core, John?
I'm glad we had the chance to try something that has this sort of reputation. I'm looking forward to doing some Roland Emmerich.
All right. So next week, we'll be back with another movie or television show to discuss. Until then, it's time for a deep dish pepperoni pizza, green peppers, onions, extra mushrooms, then a shower, and then back to the classroom. See y'all next time.
Popcorn Science is hosted by Catherine Niche and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make their way to your favorite podcasting service.